From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
To call this Blackwater Gate would be an understatement. You have two Blackwater operatives killed in the worst bombing against the CIA since the 1980s. The German government is probing allegations that Blackwater ran a secret assassination ring inside of Germany. And you have the dismissal of murder charges against Blackwater, meaning the company may literally get away with murder. This isn't under the Bush administration. This is under the Obama administration.
Investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill on Blackwater will also speak with Illinois Representative Jan Schakowsky. She's calling for an investigation into why Blackwater operatives were at the bombing of the CIA in Afghanistan. Then what does the future hold for Yemeni prisoners at Guantanamo?
Given the unsettled situation, I've spoken to the Attorney General, and we've agreed that we will not be transferring additional detainees back to Yemen at this time.
We'll talk to British journalist Andy Worthington in London, author of the Guantanamo Files, and we'll be joined by a Dutchman who's one of the first known HIV-positive people to legally visit the United States in 22 years. The lifting of the travel ban on foreigners with HIV took effect this week. We'll also be joined by his partner and the LGBT Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two former Blackwater operatives have been charged with murder in the shooting deaths of Afghan civilians last year. Justin Cannon and Christopher Drotliff were arrested Thursday following their indictment by a federal grand jury. The news broke just hours after it was revealed Blackwater had reached a settlement for the shootings of around 70 Iraqis. Blackwater is reportedly paying $100,000 for each of the Iraqis killed by its forces and between $20,000 to $30,000 to each Iraqi wounded. News of the settlement came a week after a federal judge dismissed manslaughter charges against five Blackwater operatives involved in the Nisour Square massacre that killed 17 Iraqi civilians. We'll have more on Blackwater after headlines. The Obama administration's released a report on the intelligence lapses that failed to prevent the botched Christmas Day jetliner attack. The report says the U.S. received, quote, discrete pieces of intelligence to identify the suspect. Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, as early as October, should have kept him off the plane. Abdulmutallab was ultimately flagged for extra screening while the plane was in flight, singling out the National Counterterrorism Center and the CIA. The report also says U.S. intelligence agencies had focused too heavily on al-Qaeda plans to strike U.S. targets in Yemen instead of directly inside the United States. Speaking from the White House, President Obama said he'd ordered changes to address the security lapses.
I am less interested in passing out blame than I am in learning from and correcting these mistakes to make us safer. For ultimately, the buck stops with me. As president, I have a solemn responsibility to protect our nation and our people. And when the system fails, it is my responsibility.
Yemen's issued its strongest warning to date against U.S. military intervention inside its borders. Speculation of a U.S. military campaign inside Yemen has grown since the disclosure of the suspect in the failed Christmas Day jetliner attack met with al-Qaeda operatives in Yemen last year. On Thursday, Yemen's deputy prime minister, Rashad al-Alimi, said, quote, if there is direct U.S. intervention by the United States, it'll strengthen al-Qaeda. We cannot accept any foreign troops on Yemeni territory. The U.S. has increased airport screening in the wake of the failed Christmas Day attack, prompting concerns over racial profiling. A Canadian Muslim woman has come forward with allegations she was harshly treated while trying to enter the United States last week. Ayat Mana says she was picked out of a line and questioned by U.S. Customs agents at Halifax International Airport on her way to visiting her husband in Ohio. Mana says she was refused entry after a four-hour interrogation. In an interview with Canadian television, Mana said she believes she was singled out for wearing the traditional Muslim headscarf. Her case comes as former New York City Mayor Ed Koch has ignited a controversy for claiming hundreds of millions of Muslims are terrorists. Koch made the comments Thursday in an interview with Fox News.
Of course, the vast majority of Muslims, there are 1,400,000,000, are not terrorists, but there are hundreds of millions who are. They want to kill every Christian, every Jew, every Hindu who won't convert. And we ought to put it on the table.
The family of the suicide bomber who attacked a CIA base in Afghanistan last week has revealed new details about his background. In an interview with the New York Times, a brother of Humam Khalil al-Balawi said their family had last heard from Balawi when he was volunteering as a medical doctor to treat wounded Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The brother says Balawi was, quote, changed by Israel's three-week assault on Gaza that killed over 1,300 Palestinians. In Afghanistan, new figures show children account for the most deaths in the over eight-year U.S.-led war. The Afghanistan Rights Monitor says over 1,050 people under the age of 18 were killed in Afghanistan last year, an average of at least three every day. The Pentagon says it's opened a probe into allegations two Afghan teens were beaten and tortured while imprisoned at the Bagram Air Base last year. The teens, Issa Mohammed and Abdul Rashid, were 17, the younger 16 at the time. They say they were punched and slapped in the face, photographed naked, deprived of sleep while being held in solitary confinement. Rashid said he was also forced to look at pornography. Meanwhile, a Washington, D.C. appeals court has begun hearing arguments in the government attempt to prevent three Bagram prisoners from challenging their detention. The Obama administration's appealing a lower court ruling granting the prisoners habeas corpus rights because they were seized outside Afghanistan. The Obama White House has continued the Bush administration policy of refusing to recognize the legal rights of foreign prisoners held overseas. A top U.N. official says he believes video footage apparently showing Sri Lankan soldiers summarily executing Tamils during clashes last year is authentic. The video shows what appears to be Sri Lankan soldiers killing unarmed, naked and blindfolded Tamils. Sri Lanka has dismissed the videos as a forgery. But on Thursday, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings, Philip Alston, said the tape is authentic and called for an independent inquiry.
The conclusion clearly is that the videotape is authentic. I have therefore called upon the government of Sri Lanka to respond to these allegations. And the conclusion that I've reached is the following. In light of the persistent flow of other allegations of extrajudicial executions committed by both sides during the closing phases of the war against the LTTE, I call for an independent inquiry to be established to carry out an impartial investigation into war crimes and other grave violations of international humanitarian and human rights law allegedly committed in Sri Lanka.
UN Rapporteur Philip Alston. In Israel and the occupied territories, at least three Palestinians were killed Thursday when Israeli warplanes bombed the Gaza Strip. The dead reportedly included a 15-year-old Palestinian boy. Several more Palestinians were wounded. Back in the United States, newly disclosed emails show the Federal Reserve Bank of New York asked the bailed-out insurance giant AIG to hide details on the billions of dollars it paid to banks at the height of the financial meltdown. In what some have called the backdoor bailout, AIG gave nearly $13 billion to Goldman Sachs and tens of billions more to other firms, including Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and several foreign banks. The newly revealed emails show the New York Fed deleted a reference in an AIG regulatory filing documenting payments to Goldman Sachs and the French bank Société Générale. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was head of the New York Fed at the time. An exhaustive new scientific study concludes the coal mining practice of mountaintop removal is so dangerous to the environment and public health that it should be banned. Published in the journal Science, the study by a team of 12 scientists is said to be the most comprehensive look at mountaintop removal to date. The study says increases in birth defects, cancers, fish kill and water contamination were among the effects of mountaintop removal. The study's lead author, Margaret Palmer of the University of Maryland researcher, said, quote, "Scientists are not usually that comfortable coming out with policy recommendations, but this time the results were overwhelming. The only conclusion that one can reach is that mountaintop mining needs to be stopped." The study comes on the heels of this week's controversial approval of a new mining permit for the Hobbit 45 mine in West Virginia. The Environmental Protection Agency has unveiled new standards for regulating smog. The new standards would set the primary standard for smog levels at 60 to 70 parts per billion. The standard falls in line with proposals from agency scientists that the Bush administration rejected in 2008. Frank O'Donnell of the group Clean Air Watch said the move could mark, quote, the single most important environmental decision that the EPA makes this year. And a new government survey shows an increasing rate of sexual abuse of jailed youth in U.S. juvenile prisons and other facilities. According to the first national survey of youth in custody, 1 in 10 youths reported sexual abuse by staffers in the previous 12 months. Gay and lesbian youths reported abuse at a higher rate of 1 in 5. Jamie Fellner of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch said, quote, the high rates of victimization are powerful testimony to the failure of governments to safeguard the boys and girls in their care. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Well, Blackwater is all over the news. In the last 72 hours, a series of breaking developments involving the notorious private military firm have come to light, ranging from their involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq and even Germany, as well as legal cases here at home. In the latest news, two former Blackwater operatives were arrested yesterday on murder charges, stemming from their alleged involvement in the shooting deaths of two Afghan civilians in Kabul in May. The news broke just hours after it was revealed Blackwater had reached a settlement with Iraqi victims of a string of shootings, including the Nasur Square massacre, who had sued the company for what they called senseless slaughter. Blackwater is reportedly paying $100,000 for each of the Iraqis killed by its forces and between $20,000 to $30,000 to each Iraqi wounded. News of the settlement came a week after a federal judge dismissed manslaughter charges against five Blackwater operatives involved in the Nasur Square massacre that killed 17 Iraqi civilians. Then on Wednesday, prosecutors in Germany announced they had launched a preliminary investigation into a report that the CIA and Blackwater had planned a secret operation in 2004 to assassinate a German citizen in Hamburg with suspected ties to al-Qaeda.
And last but not least, Blackwater's continued involvement with the CIA surfaced this week when it was revealed two Blackwater contractors were among the 8 dead in the December 30th suicide bombing at the CIA station in Khost, Afghanistan. Last month, the CIA announced the agency had canceled its contract with Blackwater. Illinois Representative John Schakowsky, a leading member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the chair of the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, says she'll launch an investigation. Congressmember Schakowsky joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C., and we're joined here in the studio by investigative journalist, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, author of the international bestseller Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jeremy, let's begin with you. The piece you have in The Nation magazine says, Blackwater and the Khost bombing, is the CIA deceiving Congress? Two Blackwater operatives killed there?
My understanding is that there were two Blackwater operatives killed at this bombing. One was a former Navy SEAL. The other was an Army Master Chief Sergeant. And that there was a third Blackwater operative that was wounded in the blast, I understand from my sources. Let's remember here that this was the worst attack on a CIA base that we know about since the 1980s. And here you have three Blackwater guys in the center of this blast at the time. Now, we're not sure what the role was of the Blackwater guys there, and that's what Representative Schakowsky is investigating right now. But let's say for a moment that they were doing security, because Blackwater has, since 2002, had a contract with the CIA to do force protection in Afghanistan for the CIA. They not only guard static outposts of the CIA, but when CIA operatives move around the country, Blackwater guys travel with them as their security. So if they were doing the security there, and you have on their watch this incredibly devastating attack, not just against some random CIA outpost in the middle of Canada or something, but against the epicenter of the forward operating maneuvers that the intelligence community of the U.S. is engaged in to hunt down Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden, because this asset made it onto that base, we understand, claiming that he had just met with Ayman al-Zawahiri. So how is it that he walks in there with explosives? And then I think that should be one of the things that's investigated as Congresswoman Schakowsky takes this on.
Well, Congresswoman Schakowsky, your concerns about this latest report and what you're hoping to look into?
The regardless of what the role that the Blackwater operatives were playing in this incident, why is the CIA, why is any unit of the government, the State Department, the Department of Defense, why would anyone hire this company, which is a repeat offender, threatening the mission of the United States, threatening, endangering the lives of American, CIA and military, and also known to threaten and kill innocent civilians? It is just amazing to me, astonishing to me, that we still find Blackwater anywhere in the employ of the United States government at any place around the world.
Now, during the primaries, Hillary Clinton supported a ban on Blackwater. President Obama didn't. How does that relate to what you're introducing now, the legislation that you're introducing?
Look, I'm introducing legislation called Stop Outsourcing Our Security, and the idea of that is that when we have mission-sensitive activities, inherently governmental functions, in battle zones around the world, that we should have only people that bear the stamp of the United States government, and that means that would include no private military contractors at all in those operations. Now, look, when we have a situation where you can question whether or not these contractors can get away with murder, after all, this case against those shooters at Nisar Square has been dismissed. Hopefully, that there will be another effort by the Justice Department to go after these people because it was dismissed for prosecutorial misconduct, which is true. I think there were many mistakes made. But right now, these contractors are in a legal limbo. And so if these individuals can get away with murder, imagine, you don't have to imagine, you know what it does to our relations with the Iraqi government and with governments around the world. And now you've got a situation where Germany is asking, what were Blackwater people doing in Germany?
Well, I'd like to ask you about that in particular, Congresswoman. Here you have a situation not just of being involved in murder, but apparently of being involved in government-sanctioned assassination attempts, and that is being, to some degree, contracted out. Forget about whether the government should be involved in such a kind of assassination attempts, but to contract out that activity, that is really astounding.
Part of an ongoing investigation that I can't talk about, but even the fact that there is that allegation, I think, gives one a picture of the degree to which Blackwater has been completely enmeshed in these secret operations, at least the allegation that they are, I think, is disturbing enough. And there is an investigation going on around activities, like that.
Jeremy Scahill, what do you know about what happened?
Well, Eric Prince gave this interview to Vanity Fair magazine, and he gave the interview to a former CIA lawyer, Adam Saralsky, who himself has had a history of doing what's called graymailing, which is that you believe or you fear that the government is going to come after you in some way, and so you then leak parts of information about what it was that you were involved with, which is what Eric Prince was doing in that Vanity Fair article, as a way of sort of saying to the government, if you come after me, I'll blow the whistle on all these things. One of the things, though, that came out in that article is that Eric Prince, shortly after 9/11, assembled, he claims, a team, a secret clandestine team for the CIA that trained not at any of the official CIA facilities, but at one of Eric Prince's homes in Virginia. He trains this team, and then they deployed around the world, and they would go into countries, and in the parlance of the intelligence community, they would go in dark, meaning that in some cases, the CIA chief of station in the countries that they went into wasn't even notified that they were going in there. So what Representative Schakowsky is talking about here, or Juan, you're asking about, is that one of these operations allegedly took place in Hamburg, Germany, where a Blackwater-led team inserted inside of Germany to hunt down this man who was a Syrian-born naturalized citizen of Germany that had been alleged to have had connections with three of the 9/11 plotters. And they were doing what's called, they were trying to find him, fix his location, and finish him off, is what they call it. And my understanding is that someone actually in government, not a Blackwater person, called off that operation, so the trigger was never pulled. Another operation took place, we understand, inside of Dubai. And Eric Prince talks about working on covert operations inside of Syria as well, where he was helping the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, the special forces, identify targets inside of Syria. So all of this needs to be very deeply probed, because you have not only a situation where these hit teams are being contracted out, but the German politicians are now saying, what if the German intelligence outsourced to a private company assassination operations in New Orleans in the United States? How would your government respond to this? So this could be a substantial diplomatic problem for the Obama administration, because the Merkel government is now starting to ask questions, not just Green Party politicians, but today one of Angela Merkel's biggest allies in Germany said that they're probing it and they want answers from Washington.
Congressmember Schakowsky, what kind of support do you have from the White House on either of your efforts, the legislation to stop outsourcing or the investigation?
Well, we have met with various agencies about the issue of just the outsourcing of security issues and security matters in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And I think that the thing that's really frightening is it seems that the United States military, the United States government, doesn't have the capacity, at least when we talk about private security contractors, to do the job, and seems to think that it is makes us more agile and nimble to be able to contract out. My question is, how many times do we have to does the mission have to be endangered, or do people have to be killed before we understand that it is so important for us to have people who are within the standard chain of command, where the accountability mechanisms are built in, who aren't going to go rogue on us and do things that are improper, and so far what we're finding is that even in Iraq and Jeremy was able to turn that up, that contracts that were supposed to be terminated continued because Blackwater had a capacity that even the United States government does not have. This is a very unwholesome, unhealthy situation. We have to build that that capacity, and we have to end this relationship with companies that don't have the same standard of transparency and accountability as those who work directly for the United States of America.
And, Jeremy, what about that Iraq situation, the Nusra Square killings? There were some settlements that Blackwater has reached with some of the victims, but not all of them. And what's been the reaction of the Iraqi government to the acquittals of the Blackwater people?
Well, first on the settlement that was announced yesterday, we're talking about not just the Nusra Square massacre, but we're also talking about six other incidents, the shooting of bodyguards at an Iraqi TV station, the killing of three other individuals shortly before Nusra Square. And my understanding from sources is that the victims who—the families of people who died were paid somewhere in the ballpark of $100,000, and then injuries were compensated between $20,000 and $30,000, and then there were a couple of people that got more because of the nature of their injuries. But you're talking about Blackwater. They get $1.5 billion in Iraq. 90% of this company's revenue comes from the U.S. government. For them to pay, you know, $5-6 million is chump change. In fact, one source that's been involved with these cases told me that Blackwater got a real bargain here. And indeed, Blackwater released a statement saying that they were pleased with it and it allows the company to get on with its business. But what one story that people are not really looking at, the way that these guys got off on these manslaughter charges for Nusra Square is identical to the way that Oliver North got off on the criminal charges stemming from Iran-Contra, because they were granted immunity by the State Department immediately after this shooting. And so the prosecutors then, from the Justice Department, could not use any information from the statements that they gave because they'd been promised immunity by the State Department. Why on earth did the State Department give these guys immunity? These are the prime suspects, and you give them an immunity that generally is reserved for people that you're trying to flip as witnesses, not the actual suspects. But I spoke to—and this is something no one's reported yet—I spoke to a source with direct knowledge of the U.S. military's official investigation of Nisour Square. And this source told me that the U.S. military had determined that it was a criminal event, that there was unprovoked fire, and this is what the important part is, and that the military had determined that those men who did the shooting at Nisour Square were not entitled to immunity under the Bremer-era Order 17 that granted immunity to contractors because they shot unprovoked civilians, which violated the terms of their contract, and had disobeyed orders from superiors not to leave a post where they were, meaning that they were not eligible for that immunity, and the military determined that the appropriate legal venue would have been in Iraq, that the Iraqis should have been allowed to go and arrest those individuals, but they were secretly ferried out of Iraq in the dead of night by the State Department and Blackwater, taken to the U.S., where they then got off on murder, on manslaughter charges, on the same technicality that Oliver North got off.
Could they be extradited?
Well, Scott Horton, who is an international and military law expert that you interviewed last week, I talked to him about this, and the United States and Iraq do have an extradition treaty of 1934. The Status of Forces Agreement gives Iraq jurisdiction, and if they were ineligible for Order 17, immunity, then Iraq could say that the appropriate place for their trial, now that you've been failed to do it for technical reasons, would in fact be in Iraq.
And was that military determination done before they left the country or afterwards?
The military started an investigation within less than an hour of the last bullets being fired there. They went on the scene, they gathered forensic evidence, but this was an investigation that went on for months. And so it's not as though the military determined it within 24 hours and said, oh, wait a minute, we have to hand these guys over to Iraqis. It was the military looking and carefully and meticulously documenting this incident and then saying this was improper, that they were removed from the country.
In the settlement, which is incredibly low, $100,000 per death, did some of the Iraqi families want to pull out?
Well, first of all, there is another lawsuit. There are other Iraqis that have different legal representation, and there's a case that's gotten no attention yet in the state of North Carolina. The man who was perhaps the single most prominent witness to the Nisour Square shooting, he was driving a vehicle right behind the first vehicle that the Blackwater guys shot. His 9-year-old son was shot in the head. His head exploded on a van, on his cousins and other people in the vehicle. That man has retained counsel in North Carolina and is suing. That could be a very problematic case for Blackwater because they're not only suing Eric Prince of Blackwater, they're suing the individual shooters in state court in North Carolina. So that could be the one that ends up actually going to trial. There also, you can read it in the papers, there were some of the plaintiffs in this case were very, very disappointed in the settlement that they got and felt that $100,000 for a death is a complete injustice.
Finally, the latest news of the two former Blackwater operatives who were arrested on murder charges stemming from the killing of
two Afghans. Remember, these killings took place under the Obama administration. And what's significant about this is that the men who are alleged to have murdered, this second-degree murder charges or the indictment, two Afghan civilians, were there as military trainers. These weren't security operatives. The Obama administration is dramatically expanding the U.S. training of Afghan forces, meaning that you're going to have more of these types of guys on the ground. So these individuals were alleged to have opened fire unprovoked on a civilian vehicle, killing two people. They weren't guarding any diplomats. They weren't even in the country to be guarding anyone. They were there as trainers, and yet they're involved with this incident that has caused some significant diplomatic problems between the U.S. And the Karzai government.
Congresswoman Schakowsky, I'd like to ask you finally, in terms of how, in your experience, and how the military is reacting to these continual problems with Blackwater and how it's affecting its ability to continue its mission, whether it's in Iraq or in Afghanistan?
Well, I think there's a good deal of resentment in general toward the contractors. You know, the companies like Blackwater recruit out of the military. We train them. They take the highly skilled people and they skim them off. They pay them a good deal more. They are indistinguishable often to the people on the ground, to the Iraqis or the Afghans, from people who are actually in the military, and yet they conduct themselves in a much more reckless way, and often, not always. And so I think that the military itself, I'm talking now not about necessarily the top brass, but would appreciate the fact if the jobs were done by the military themselves, as opposed to hiring out these companies who have proven themselves to be so unreliable and dangerous.
We're going to leave it there. Congressmember Jen Schakowsky, leading member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, chair of the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, thanks for joining us from Washington, D.C. And Jeremy Scahill, thank you so much for your work. Investigative journalist, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Democracy Now! Correspondent. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to London. What will happen to the Yemeni prisoners who are supposed to be released from Guantanamo but aren't being? Stay with us. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, next week will mark the 8th anniversary of the first transfer of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Although President Obama came into office last year promising to close down the infamous detention center, nearly 200 men are still imprisoned in Guantanamo. As the Obama administration grapples with security concerns stemming from the attempted airline bombing on Christmas, the future of these men hangs in the balance. On Tuesday, President Obama noted that the would-be bomber had received training in Yemen and emphasized his links to a Yemeni branch of al-Qaeda. He went on to announce that he had suspended the transfer of any more Guantanamo detainees to Yemen. About half of the men remaining in Guantanamo are from Yemen.
Given the unsettled situation, I've spoken to the Attorney General, and we've agreed that we will not be transferring additional detainees back to Yemen at this time. But make no mistake, we will close Guantanamo prison, which has damaged our national security interests and become a tremendous recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. In fact, that was an explicit rationale for the formation of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And as I've always said, we will do so. We will close the prison in a manner that keeps the American people safe and secure.
Meanwhile, classified Pentagon assessments show an increase in the number of prisoners released from Guantanamo who've joined militant groups like al-Qaeda. For more on the future of Guantanamo and the men still being held there, we're joined now from London by journalist and author Andy Worthington. His book is called The Guantanamo Files, The Stories of the 774 Detainees in America's Illegal Prison. He's co-director of the film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Explain what you understand will happen to these Yemeni prisoners, Andy.
Hi there. Well, I'm not sure what's going to happen to them. I mean, the president didn't put a time limit on how long he's going to wait before all this dies down and before he can and get some more of these men transferred back to Yemen. Because without it, clearly, it's going to be next to impossible to close the prison. And I think that's really the worrying thing about how this deadline has slipped. You know, last year in the executive order, the president announced that the prison would close by January the 22nd. He conceded 2 months ago that that deadline was going to be missed, but he hasn't set a new one. How long is it going to take? How will these things just roll on forever? I think it's very hard to tell at the moment, and that's really quite disappointing.
Well, Andy Worthington, many conservative leaders have been criticizing the administration, especially for the most recent release of six of the prisoners. But there was not a whole lot of furor over the approximately 500 or more released under the Bush administration. Could you talk about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the, I was absolutely shocked by the hysteria that greeted this this failed bomb plot. I mean, I don't take a bomb plot lightly, but the hysteria that greeted it was so misplaced. You know, first of all, ABC News came up with a poorly researched story suggesting that the failed bomber had met with a group in Yemen, which involved two prisoners, Saudi prisoners. Released from Guantanamo. It turned out that one of these men had actually handed himself into the Yemeni authorities in February last year, several months before Abdulmutallab arrived in the country, so he clearly couldn't have been involved. We're left with this one Saudi. Now, what's been mentioned but really hasn't been made much of, and particularly hasn't been made by lawmakers and other right-wing pundits who've seized on this, is that these Saudis, this Saudi, and there are allegedly a few others, were released by George W. Bush. They were released after military review boards at Guantanamo, and they were released after the intelligence services had actually suggested that these men shouldn't be released because they thought that they constituted a danger. So it's part of a diplomatic deal that was done between the Bush administration and the Saudis. But it's nothing to do with the Yemeni prisoners in Guantanamo. It's nothing to do with Barack Obama, who's been very careful about who he's been releasing. You know, so I find that absolutely disgraceful, really. And we've ended up in this position where Yemeni prisoners who've been held, for the most part, for 8 years, who've been approved for transfer by the deliberations of the interagency task force established by President Obama this year, in some cases by the U.S. courts after having their habeas corpus petitions granted, are now being made the victim of this game of political football. And I'm disappointed that President Obama backed down. It's yet again another example of pragmatism, which really, I think, comes out as cowardice. Because John Brennan, when he went on the TV shows at the weekend, made a very strong and credible and coherent case for what the administration was doing, why it was how it was working with the Yemeni government regarding these transfers, how it was doing everything very carefully and wasn't making the same kind of mistakes that were made by the Bush administration.
I wanted
to. You know, I think it's just another example of backing down under pressure.
Andy Worthington, I wanted to ask you about this piece in the New York Times yesterday that says administration officials said that a classified Pentagon report concludes that some 560 detainees transferred abroad from the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, about one in five engaged in or suspected of engaging in terrorism or militant activity. The finding comes amid reports that one former Guantanamo detainee released in 2007 under the administration of President Bush is now involved with a branch of al-Qaeda based in Yemen, a group that President Obama said sponsored the attempt to attack the airline on Christmas Day. Andy Worthington.
Well, you know, this is really quite extraordinary, I think. I mean, we have a story which is put out by a number of supposedly reputable media outlets based on a statement by a Pentagon spokesman. Not a single shred of paper was presented to any of these media outlets indicating any names, any information whatsoever. And just, you know, just back in May last year, We had another version of this story when a Pentagon report that actually included some names said that 1 in 7 of the people released from Guantanamo had returned to the battlefield. The New York Times got in trouble. They ran a front-page story spouting this information about the 74 and failing to point out that the Pentagon had actually only named 27 people. Now, when researchers who have done a lot of work on this from the New America Foundation and from the Seton Hall Law School, their figures of the number of people who could be said possibly to have either returned to the battlefield or to have engaged in some terrorist activities in the first place was somewhere between 12 and 20, so nowhere near the 74. So what we get the other day that everybody leaps on in the media is a claim that now this figure is over 100, and yet if we compare it with what could be factually established back in May, that would mean that we've got, what, 80 or 90 people who have rejoined the battle just in the last 6 months. It's absolutely ludicrous. You know, and the Pentagon consistently produces these kind of this kind of information at useful times. I mean, it really makes me wonder who's running the show here? Who in the Pentagon is making this kind of material available the day after Barack Obama has backed down on releasing any more Yemenis, which is clearly part of a whole story that makes it more and more difficult to close Guantanamo. Whose side are they on? Whose agenda is being set here?
Andy Worthington, you've delved into a lot of the individual stories of the prisoners at Guantanamo. Tell us about some of the Yemenis that are still being held and whose continued incarceration or freedom hangs in the balance now in the decision of the Obama administration.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you know, by my reckoning, there are 86 Yemenis still in Guantanamo. About 22 were seized in Afghanistan, about 35 somewhere at the Pakistani border, perhaps crossing from Afghanistan, perhaps they'd actually been in Pakistan, and 25 were captured in house raids in various cities in Pakistan, far from Afghanistan. Now, you know, some of these men had traveled to Afghanistan for reasons of humanitarian aid or because they were missionaries. I mean, certainly not all by any means. You know, a lot of people had traveled there to help the Taliban fight against the Northern Alliance in an inter-Muslim civil war that had been going on long before the 9/11 attacks and essentially had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. But you also have quite a lot of these people who were seized in these house raids in Pakistan. Some had gone looking for cheap medical treatment. A number of these men were very clearly students. And some of the prisoners who'd been cleared were caught in a guest house in Pakistan. And several of these have been released. One of them won his habeas corpus petition last May, and Judge Kessler, when she made the ruling in his case, the case of this man, Ala Ali bin Ali Ahmed, she said that there were a number of other people in this house, and that from what she could tell, their stories were almost certainly the same. And this man was a student. The judge said that the government had relied on unreliable witnesses within Guantanamo who had made false allegations, that it had attempted to construct a mosaic of intelligence that didn't stand up to scrutiny. So she threw out the case and ordered this man to be set free. And there are clearly, you know, other people in this house who are still held in Guantanamo. They've been cleared for release. And yet it's this game of political football that is preventing them from finally being freed after 8 years. And I find that really completely unacceptable.
Andy Worthington, we want to thank you very much for being with us. His book is called The Guantanamo Files, The Stories of the 774 Detainees in America's Illegal Prison, and co-director of the film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. We will certainly continue to cover this case or these cases. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Two men just flew in last night from the Netherlands right into our studio here in New York, and we're going to talk to them about the lifting of a 22-year ban that's barred foreigners who have HIV from legally entering the United States. Stay with us. Round midnight, John Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, gay rights groups around the world are praising the United States for lifting a 22-year ban that barred foreigners who have HIV from legally entering the country without an official waiver. HIV is the virus that causes AIDS. The ban covered both visiting tourists and foreigners seeking to live here. President Obama announced the ban would be lifted in October, but the rules didn't change until this week.
22 years ago, in a decision rooted in fear rather than fact, the United States instituted a travel ban on entry into the country for people living with HIV/AIDS. Now, we talk about reducing the stigma of this disease, yet we've treated a visitor living with it as a threat. We lead the world when it comes to helping stem the AIDS pandemic, yet we are one of only a dozen countries that still bar people from HIV from entering our own country. If we want to be the global leader in combating HIV/AIDS, we need to act like it.
The United States was one of only about a dozen countries that barred people who have HIV. In 1989, the U.S. ban made international headlines when a Dutch AIDS educator named Hans Paul Verhoef attempted to travel to a gay and lesbian conference in San Francisco. He was detained in Minnesota and jailed for 4 days after the AIDS drug AZT was found in his luggage.
On Thursday, another Dutchman, Clemens Roulin, became one of the first known HIV-positive people to legally visit the United States since the travel ban was lifted. On Thursday afternoon, he flew into New York's JFK International Airport with his partner, Hugo Bosch, who is HIV-negative. Clemens Roulin was diagnosed with HIV in 97 after being infected by an ex-lover in New York. Under the travel ban, he's been barred from returning to New York until now. Well, Clemens Roulin and Hugo Bosch join us now in the studio here in New York, along with Boris Dietrich, Advocacy Director of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual and Transgender Rights Program at Human Rights Watch. We welcome you all, and welcome to New York.
Thank you.
It has been quite a journey for you. Talk about what the trip was like last night.
Well, the trip was very exciting. Even already at the Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, it was busy with the press, and we had a perfect flight over here, and then a lot of attention when we arrived at the airport and were welcomed by Boris Dietrich and the Dutch consul.
Were you asked questions when you came to JFK?
Yeah, we gave interviews at the airport.
Were you asked questions by customs officials?
No, it actually went the same way like I was used to in all the other times in the past that I flew into the U.S. So in that sense, it was no difference. It was a difference for me because it felt totally different. In the past, for example, 5 years ago when I flew in, I had to lie, like thousands of other people, lie about my HIV status to be able to visit friends and here in New York.
Why they had, where had they asked you about your HIV status that you were, had to lie?
Well, they don't ask you, but because I'm depending on my medication, I have to carry it with me. And to get it safe into the country, I always carry it in my hand luggage. So it means if they check you at customs, they might find your medication, and in that way they find out you're HIV positive.
And Boris Dietrich, how often has the U.S. government, the cases where the ban was actually exercised or imposed on travelers coming into the United States?
Well, actually, on a yearly basis, we know about cases of people having been arrested and sent back to the country of origin. Because, for instance, in the hand luggage, officers found some medication. And nowadays, you need to apply for a visa to the United States 72 hours in advance in your home country. And in the questionnaire, there were questions about do you have HIV as disease? And if you filled in yes, then already your access was denied. So a lot of people who were honest about their status were denied access to the U.S.
Talk about the struggle in this country to have this policy, the ban, lifted. bars?
Well, Human Rights Watch and a lot of other groups were campaigning against this ban for years and years, because we know that in other countries there was no ban, and even WHO and UNAIDS and all kind of international medical standards said it's ridiculous to have a ban, because it is actually a fake protection, because people go underground, you give a stigma, you discriminate people living with HIV. And because they are not honest, then when they want to enter the U.S., it gives such a negative approach that people don't want to be tested, for instance. So actually, it's counterproductive. And this has been proved in many reports, but the U.S. government didn't want to change until President Bush decided to change it. And then, of course, President Obama finished the job recently.
And what are some of the other countries that still have a ban?
Well, the good news is that, for instance, South Korea also lifted the ban. They were also persuaded by all the data and facts. But the Russian Federation, for instance, is a country that still bars people who are living with HIV to enter the country. And you get ridiculous situations. For instance, I was invited to attend an HIV/AIDS meeting in Moscow, and people who wanted to talk about what it is like to live with HIV were not allowed into Russia to talk about it, while the Russian government was supporting this meeting. So, of course, you can sometimes get a waiver, but it's very unclear, and it would be a good idea if Russia also would lift the HIV ban.
Ugo Bash, you traveled with your partner, Roland. You're HIV negative. What
Yes.
did this feel like for you coming into this country? This, we believe, is the first time someone has legally come into the country since the ban was lifted earlier this week.
Well, it was much, much more relaxed to travel to the States, because 5 years ago I was more excited than Clemens, because he is living with HIV, and so he's used to having all these questions and having to deal with it. But to me, it was a, well, of course, I traveled with him, and I experienced also a lot of anxiety, because it could mean that we would be sent back the same day if he was discovered.
Clemens, you won an essay. This is why your trip was sponsored.
Yeah.
What was the essay?
Well, we actually won it by his cartoon. Hugo made a cartoon. He's an illustrator. He made a cartoon, and together we made a little poet what comes to it. And in that poet, it refers back to the fact that I got infected here, and actually that I turn my face now to the U.S. and that I'll love to come in here is the way as I am, HIV positive, and that I'm more than just a virus. I'm just a normal person like everybody else. And you don't have to be afraid for people with HIV and AIDS.
And Ugo, the illustration, what were you illustrating?
I was illustrating someone flying in alongside the Statue of Liberty, which was welcoming him. Hey, buddy, welcome to the U.S. While he was sitting in a small plane pointing towards New York City.
And what are your plans this weekend?
First, we go to MoMA.
To the Museum of Modern
yeah.
Art.
Yes.
And you're going to spend some money here.
Yes,
we do. We shop till we drop. We came with one suitcase and going to leave with at least two.
Yes. So you see, it's good for economy as well, that people living with HIV can enter the country.
And your sense, having spent time both here in the United States and in Europe, as mm-hmm. the progress in the United States in terms of public opinion, in terms of being able to adequately accept and deal with people with HIV?
I think this will support the HIV organizations here a lot, that the exchange between people will get more and better. So I think this is for the best of everybody. Sorry.
Boris, you mentioned earlier that it was actually begun under Bush, the attempt to lift this ban,
yes.
Removing it from a list of diseases that would be banned. Does that surprise you? And yeah. why was President Bush the one who was doing this?
Well, he was the one doing this because there was so much proof that it was actually a counterproductive measure. and that it was only discriminatory and stigmatizing. There have been a lot of international agencies, like I told you, UNH, WHO, who said this doesn't serve any purpose. It's against international human rights standards. So I guess the Bush administration was persuaded to do it, and also because other countries had already lifted their ban. It surprised me because, especially in Europe, President Bush doesn't have, let's say, he's not known for progressive decisions. So when these two guys left the Netherlands, there was a lot of publicity in Europe about it. And what I learned from journalists was that they all said, well, this is actually one of the positive things that the Bush administration has done. And of course, President Barack Obama finished the job, as he told himself, by finishing it. But it was really set out by the Bush administration.
Talk about the AIDS conference that can now be held in this country and the effect that this ban has had.
Well, for instance, in 2001 and 2006, the United Nations here in New York organized a big meeting about HIV/AIDS, and I attended both meetings, and I remember that in 2001, HIV activists from other countries, some of them, were not allowed to enter the country to attend the meeting. Now, the ban has been lifted. The U.S. can organize a big international conference, and I heard President Obama say, we want to be the leader in fighting HIV/AIDS. So it would be very good to have such a conference here in New York or elsewhere in the United States and invite all kind of academics and people living with HIV to talk about the issue and to develop new approaches. This year, 2010, is also the year of universal access to testing, to treatment, to healthcare in relation to HIV/AIDS. So it would be a great thing to start preparing for such an international conference.
I'm curious. You were talking about how the Bush administration actually initiated the reversal of this policy, but then why did it take so long? After President Bush left office, a year for it to actually be implemented?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not an expert on the, let's say, American political process, but I know Congress had to have a look at it. Human Rights Watch sent several letters to the administration in order to support the idea of lifting the ban. And there was a grace period of 2 months after the announcement before it could take place. There are a lot of websites and forms that need to be changed because they still ask for your HIV status. And now that doesn't have to be taken place anymore.
Clements, I'd like to end with you reading the poem that got you on this journey, that landed you here last night.
I'm honored to read it for you. No more lies, no more pretending, no more hiding in the crevices of exclusion. Honesty to the land where once lay my destiny in one viral load. Free I am. Free to travel, to hug, to share, love, and once more be united. Alive and proud, I turn to you, America. America, here I come. Come as I am, HIV positive.
I want to thank you both very much for making your first stop here. Clemens Roland, HIV-positive Dutch man who arrived in the United States last night, the first to come here legally after the ban this week was lifted. Hugo Bosch, his partner, illustrator in the Netherlands, and Boris Dietrich. He is the LGBT advocacy director for Human Rights Watch. And that does it for our broadcast. We'd love to get your comments and suggestions for shows. You can email us at democracynow@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrifa Dokadus, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Peter Curries, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Nick Gala, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chamblee. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.